Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Academy of Florida Elder Law Attorneys, Florida's advocates for seniors and persons with disabilities. Academy of Florida Elder Law Attorneys. More information about AFELA's policies at afela.org. And from the United Faculty of Florida, representing over 20,000 faculty and graduate assistants at 13 universities and 14 colleges, working to encourage lawmakers to fund Florida's future through support of public education. Online at myuff.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Debate over whether to allow classroom teachers to carry guns gets emotional.
I firmly believe that our kids' lives should be protected by more than just hope. And for that reason, I can't vote for this bill today.
Also tonight, an effort to help cut down on a growing habit among young people falters.
1 in 4 seniors in high school have been using it, and 1 in 10 youth in middle school have been using it.
We'll also talk to a certified medical cannabis doctor about the restrictions placed on medical marijuana by the legislature last week. And we'll celebrate the golden anniversary of the Florida Commission on Human Relations and its half century of fighting housing and employment discrimination in Florida. I'm Tom Flanagan. It's day 4 of week 6 in Florida's 2019 lawmaking session, and this is Capitol Report. Florida lawmakers are responding to a report on the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas shooting with a measure that addresses concerns raised in the report's 480-plus pages. Lawmakers say it's a good bill, but noting a divide over one portion that gives districts the option to allow classroom teachers to carry guns. Lynn Hatter reports the measure is now going before the full Senate amid controversy over the issue.
The measure is wide-ranging. It addresses mental health in schools, calls for stronger incident reporting, and making more safety upgrades to facilities. When districts identify troubled students, they're directed to refer those kids to services and keep a file which would follow the child should they leave. All are issues raised by the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Commission, which was convened in the aftermath of the shooting that left 17 people dead.
I just want to remind people that this is about not just about Luke Hoyer and Martin Duquette and Gina Montalto and Alex Schachter and Alina Petty and Alyssa Alhadeff and Helena Ramsey and Carmen Chentrup and Nicholas Dorette and Carol Loughran and Joaquin Oliver and Meadow Pollock and Peter Wang and Jamie Gutenberg and Coach Hickson and Coach Weiss and Mr. Beagle. It is about every single child across this great state.
Democratic Senator Lauren Buck sat on the commission, and she says the bill as a whole will keep kids safe. She highlights part of the measure that requires districts to do threat assessments and act on them, which was not the case with the gunmen.
There was a threat assessment done on the shooter in this case. That threat assessment lived in a folder. First of all, the threat assessment was done. Nobody knew how to do it. Nobody knew how to complete it. Nobody knew what way or how it should be done. That threat assessment that was incomplete, not followed up upon, was in a folder in a principal's office somewhere, never to be looked at again. That was after a student said that he was going to drink gasoline and hurt other people.
And I really hope that I'm wrong. I hope that we're all wrong, and I hope that ultimately it will be a lot more good that comes from this than bad. But I firmly believe that our kids' lives should be protected by more than just hope. And for that reason, I can't vote for this bill today.
Republican Senator Ana Terry Flores says she can't get behind the bill. At issue is the part that allows school districts to decide whether to arm classroom teachers. Right now, those who don't just work in the classroom can carry guns at the discretion of the district. A quarter of districts in the state have implemented the so-called Guardian program, most have not. And many teachers themselves, like Barbara Alver, don't want guns in classrooms.
I'm also torn, because if I was armed, I am a gun owner, I would not like to take it to school. I think that would not be the place to have a gun.
Alver says if there were a shooter outside her classroom door, she'd face a difficult choice.
Do I leave my 20-something students that I was charged with protecting them? Do I leave them afraid and alone in a classroom to go out to pursue a gunman? Or do I stay with my students to protect them? Because I feel if I was a guardian and I did either one of those situations, I would be wrong.
Most mass shootings happen in a span of minutes, not hours. And by the time law enforcement can respond, most of the time the damage is already done. Bill sponsor Manny Diaz asks what happens when the first, second, and even third lines of defense fail.
I can assure you that after looking at these pictures and having the conversations I've had and thinking back to the time when I stood there at my school thinking of what could happen, I firmly ask this committee to continue with the bill and to make sure that all of our districts and all of our schools have the option that if all else fails, someone can save the lives of these kids.
But should teachers be that line? That remains up for debate. I'm Lynn Hatter.
The legislature is working to implement a constitutional amendment that bans vaping in indoor workplaces. But another vaping proposal appears dead for this session, as Gina Jordan reports.
A House committee this week shot down a bill that would have changed the definition of tobacco products to include nicotine products and devices that dispense them. Pensacola Republican Representative Mike Hill is the bill sponsor.
In the last few years, according to the FDA, electronic nicotine delivery systems has become an epidemic with youth. That 1 in 4 seniors in high school have been using it, and 1 in 10 youth in middle school have been using it.
The bill would require businesses that sell these products to pay a small fee and get a permit from the state to be a tobacco dealer. These products would have to be sold face-to-face and not through a vending machine in most cases. Jacksonville Republican Representative Jason Fisher asked Hill for more information about why the bill is needed.
Why does the state of Florida need to get involved in the marketplace on this issue?
Representative Hill, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The reason, Representative Fisher, is because we're seeing this increased usage of nicotine electronic delivery systems by our children. And we know that nicotine has a negative effect on our youth, especially those under the age of 18, that it can affect their brain development and also has a tendency to make them become dependent or on nicotine.
It's already illegal in Florida for those under age 18 to buy or possess tobacco products like regular cigarettes. This bill would add vaping devices to that group, even if the device doesn't contain nicotine. 42-year-old Albert Harper from Clearwater spoke against the bill during public testimony.
It's our death, the consumer, by either tax, black market it would cause, or dangerous DIY methods. We all want that. And then you open the door for big tobacco to come in and monopolize the entire thing.
Harper is a veteran who runs social media pages dedicated to educating consumers about vaping. He says the bill will devastate the average consumer's accessibility to tobacco reduction products like e-cigarettes.
It would require reputable vaping businesses to have a tobacco licensing, right? Although there's no tobacco in a vaping product. Only some nicotine and some e-liquid. Not all e-liquid has nicotine in it. The same businesses that helped me, my wife, my nephew, and a lot of my family members to not become part of that death statistic from cigarettes, you would be wiping these people out.
Like most of the speakers, Kissimmee Democratic Representative John Cortez opposed the bill. He wants more emphasis on regulating vaping devices.
I had a teacher come to my office and talk to me about the middle school kids and the high school kids using those vapor products to put other stuff in them. So I think we should be focusing on the product that they use and see what we can do with that, because that's a big problem in the schools, and she stated that to me.
Jacksonville Democratic Representative Kimberly Daniels was the only speaker to say she supports the proposal.
This is not a crazy bill. The idea is not crazy. And being on the streets in contact with young people You know, we don't know what they're putting in those pipes, and we can't control that. But I'm saying this, this is not a crazy, but common sense.
Daniels delivered one of three yes votes to eight no votes. That halts momentum for the bill in the House, and the Senate version is not scheduled for any committee hearings. I'm Gina Jordan.
Still to come on Capitol Report, will legal limits on the amount of THC in medical marijuana deprive Florida patients of needed relief? A prominent physician specializing in medical cannabis doesn't think so.
I think the access they have with the percentage of products in like vapes, inhalation products, and tinctures provides enough in that area percentage-wise to help them.
And will mark the six-month anniversary of Hurricane Michael's assault on the Florida Panhandle.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org.
A bill filed last week would set a limit on the amount of THC that can be dispensed to 10%. The bill also allows military veterans to waive their yearly $75 medical marijuana card fee. Opponents don't like the first part and think tying it to the veterans' fee waiver is bad policy. Blaise Gainey spoke with Dr. Mark Moore, a certified medical cannabis physician, about his thoughts.
I'm here with Dr. Mark Moore at MedCan Florida, the first physician's office for medical cannabis here in Florida. And how are you doing today, sir?
Very well. Thank you, Blaise.
All right. And I wanted to talk with you about the 10% cap that the legislature is proposing. Do you think that, just really quickly, do you think that'll be enough for patients?
The 10% cap is to be applied to smokables only. Currently, there are no caps on any other products in medical cannabis. I think patients have access to a varied number of products, including vapes, tinctures, oral capsules, that are over the 10% limit. So I don't think there's as much of an issue as there might be had that not been available.
Got you. And for patients that do want to use smokables and are maybe used to 50%, going down to 10%, will that change a lot?
What you mean when you say they're used to 50%, they have been using other products that have higher percentages of THC. Some of those percentages go way above 50, all the way up to 90%. These are not whole flower products. They are manufactured products. Most natural cannabis has a THC level today of anywhere from 10 to 20%. So patients would never use much more than that anyway. Many popular brands of cannabis in California, for example, are in the 10% range. So this is not unreasonable.
All right. And I know a lot of patients use this as a way to get off of opioids, which is a harder medicine and can lead to death. We see a lot of opioid addictions and overdoses. Have you seen a lot of your patients come in and do they possibly use this as a way to get off of opioids?
Definitely patients today in the United States have there's a lot of patients with opiate problems. Patients can use cannabis, it appears, to help withdrawal from opiates and to help make a shift in their pain treatment. I think the access they have with the percentage of products in like vapes, inhalation products, and tinctures provides enough in that area percentage-wise to help them.
Earlier you talked about that 10% cap is only on smokables. You think there should be another cap on the tinctures, on the oils, on the other forms?
That's a good question, Blaise. The milligrams of THC is supposed to be capped and limited under Florida law. A number hasn't been determined at this time. And so that number may be one of the most important numbers to find for the patients, because it's really about how much you take every day, not so much what the percentages are. If you were to take one aspirin a day, that may not affect you, no matter what the percentage of aspirin in that pill was. But if you were to take 50 aspirin per day, it would not be good for you.
And another good part about this bill that a lot of people wanted, it will allow veterans, military veterans, to waive their license fee. I'm not sure if you have any military veterans as patients here, but do you think that is something that will also help them? Because a lot of times they are prescribed opioids to deal with some of the traumas that they get from being at war.
Yes. I mean, I think any time we can help veterans is a good thing. What would help veterans is again, more access, more competition, lower prices of product. I don't know if the $75 one-time discount a year is going to make a difference or not. I think lower prices would help people. I think if you really wanted to help veterans, maybe there'll be a bill to allow patients to grow their own. One plant, allow veterans to grow their own medicine. That might be something that would really help them.
Yeah, that would definitely save in the cost, since they would be growing their own medicine. Yeah. As far as kids, they still cannot smoke unless they are approved of it. Now, we did talk about the fact that the higher percentages you get in the other tinctures, you know, could cause a psychoactive effect, possibly. Have you seen any of this?
So your question is about children under the age of 18 and the issue of psychosis. Yes, there's definite evidence in research that that's been recently reconfirmed that the higher the percentages of THC, the increase in psychosis and maybe schizophrenic type reactions. It's not just about the percentage, it's about the amount of THC. If you have a product that's 20% and it's got 200 milligrams of THC, it's no different than if you had a 10% product, you had twice as much of it. If you're still getting 200 milligrams THC, that may be too much. So a lot of states have limits that are closer to 100 milligrams per day.
And that's what you all go with here, correct?
That's one of the guidelines we use, yes.
And in the bill, they have 2.5 ounces, I believe, every 30 days. Do you think that is a good number, or too high, too low?
Experience that I have seen, you know, in the general public, a regular user, that's a bolded regular user, might use anywhere from half an ounce to up to an ounce. That's a daily, multiple time a day regular user. So based on that, that seems like that would be enough for any patient, up to an ounce. The point is, while cannabis is medicine in the state of Florida, there should be reasonable limitations and reasonable numbers when applied to these medicines. That's because it is being used as medicine.
All right, thank you so much.
That was Blaise Ganey speaking with certified medical cannabis physician Dr. Mark Moore. Today marks the 50th anniversary of the Florida Commission on Human Relations, which was created by the legislature to prevent discrimination in things like housing and employment. Ryan Daly spoke with Representative Geraldine Thompson, who, prior to being a lawmaker, served on and at one time chaired the commission.
So it's the commission's 50th anniversary. For our listeners, could you tell them a little bit about the commission itself?
Well, after the Civil Rights Act was passed in the United States, and that occurred in 1964, then it was up to the states to address continuing discrimination. And the commission was organized to address discrimination that occurred in housing, in employment and in public accommodations. And housing, we were having issues where people were not allowed to purchase homes in certain neighborhoods, where people were not allowed to rent in certain communities, because if perhaps they had a family and the person who owned the property didn't want a family. That's discrimination. We also saw in housing that people were not allowed to rent properties because of their race or because of their sexual orientation or whatever, and those are discriminatory as well. So housing was a big issue, as well as employment. Just because you pass a law doesn't mean that people change their behaviors overnight. So the commission investigated charges of discrimination in employment and prohibited discrimination on the basis of gender and race and age and disability, and they continue to do that. This is 50 years later after they were established, and we continue to see those problems, unfortunately, in the state of Florida. The Florida Commission on Human Relations has a relationship where they share work with the EEOC, and rather than send people from a federal agency to investigate charges that are brought by Floridians, the EEOC will pay the Florida Commission to investigate those charges and to serve our citizens. They do the same thing with HUD, Housing and Urban Development, when there are charges of discrimination based on housing, et cetera, and public accommodations, where you saw people who were not served at lunch counters, who could not rent hotel rooms, any public accommodations, who could not ride on buses, et cetera. So for public accommodations, the Florida Commission on Human Relations is also the agency that investigates charges. And they additionally have a responsibility to do training and to work with employers, to work with the real estate agencies, to work with hotels, so that they don't violate the law, and so that you deal with the problems on the front end rather than responding to them on the back end.
So having that resource, like a state investigatory agency, that can be done more effectively by the state rather than a federal agency?
Absolutely, because in terms of the time that it would take, and if you had to send someone from Washington, D.C., for example, with EEOC, the time to travel, and these are people who know these communities. They know the state of Florida, and so they're able to work with individuals to help get the cases resolved in a more timely manner. Unfortunately, the state of Florida has diverted money that would have gone to the commission to other things because they have these work-sharing agreements with HUD and with EEOC. And so we should not expect the federal government to pay for these investigations and for the training and for community outreach when the state should be funding those things. This should be in addition to. And over the years, we've seen the funding for the commission cut year after year after year. And I understand that Governor DeSantis has made a commitment to making sure that the commission has the resources that it needs to adequately serve Floridians.
Final question. I won't hold you up anymore here, but, you know, 50 years, quite the milestone. Is the work as important as ever that the agency does?
It absolutely is. Unfortunately, we still have people who, for whatever reason, want to exclude other people. And they come up with various reasons for the exclusion. And it violates the law, not only in the state of Florida, but the United States of America. And so the work of the commission continues to be vitally important.
That was Florida State Representative Geraldine Thompson, a former chair of the Florida Commission on Human Relations, speaking with Ryan Daly. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, Today is the six-month anniversary of Hurricane Michael's assault on the Florida Panhandle. WUFT's Nicole Rogers has more on how cities in the region are holding up.
Half a year later, Panama City and Mexico Beach are still in shambles. On the six-month anniversary of Hurricane Michael hitting Florida's coast, over 70 organizations came together to host a Pray for Bay event. The event was meant to unify the community and provide outreach. Mexico Beach Mayor Al Cathy attended the event, saying 80% of his city was destroyed in the hurricane.
You know, when you dance, you got to play the fiddle. We live on the coast of Florida. I have watched for years people in Alabama, Texas, Miami. I mean, and I thought, oh my goodness, I hurt for them.
Cathy says the city has a $50 million debris bill with an annual budget of just $3 million.
Well, you know, our number got drawn. We didn't think it'd be 155 mile an hour winds with 17 and a half feet of water. The largest documented storm on the coast of Florida. But that's what we got. So we deal with it and we move on.
Cathy says Governor Ron DeSantis' recent announcement on Hurricane Irma relief funding concerns him. FEMA Media Relations Specialist Leo Skinner says federal agencies have supplied over $1.1 million in grants, loans, and claims from their flood insurance programs.
So altogether, FEMA can't do it by itself. There's no way that we can just come in and get people back to the way they were before. But through other federal agencies and local communities, I think we do a fairly good job of providing the support that people need.
Skinner says FEMA has put 20,000 people in hotels through a TSA program and will continue giving their best efforts to help victims. Bay County Commissioner Philip Griff Griffiths says Bay County residents feel like they've been forgotten about. Griffiths says there haven't been enough efforts made by United States congressmen.
I'll fly him down here. I'll pay for it out of my pocket to fly a congressman. If he wants to see it, come on down. I'll take you on a tour 6 months later and show you what devastation looks like.
He said he is proud of the efforts that have been made. He also says the estimated damage assessment is around $661 million, and they have a long way to go.
I think everybody's a little worried. We're kind of living in an unknown. It's a purgatory, you know, somewhere between heaven and hell, I guess.
Griffith says they performed the largest debris removal done by a county in American history. The idea of the Pray for Bay event was to show community members, though they may feel otherwise, they are not being forgotten about. Nicole Rogers.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaze Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Sean Mulcahy. Thanks also to WUFT's Nicole Rogers. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Be sure to join us again every weeknight throughout the Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Academy of Florida Elder Law Attorneys. Florida's advocates for seniors and persons with disabilities. Academy of Florida Elder Law Attorneys. More information about AFELA's policies at afela.org. And from the United Faculty of Florida, representing over 20,000 faculty, staff professionals, and graduate assistants at 13 universities and 14 colleges. Advocates for quality higher education for all Floridians. Online at myuff.org.